In our prayer with Wally, we thank God for the quiet place that we have assembled here tonight. We are indeed blessed. There are people that assemble for Bible study in buildings that they're sitting on little benches, ground dirt is the floor, and no air conditioning or heating. Some of them walk quite a distance. Here we are blessed to get in a nice automobile and drive here and sit in this comfortable place. And it's something we need to be aware of and certainly thank our God for. Also in Wally's prayer, he talked about the need for us to pay attention to our marriages. And that is absolutely the best thing we can do. If there's anything we can derive out of this kind of a study, when we see the consequences of broken marriages, to cause us to pay attention, to take the time and exert the effort to cultivate the marriages that we may be in and to encourage others to do the same. In our study, we are looking at 1 Corinthians chapter 7, and you can see on the lesson, we're going to be looking at verses 12 through 16, 27 through 28, and 39 through 40. In our class on Sunday morning, we covered some in these verses, 10, 11, and somewhat in 12 and 13. Before I get into the lesson tonight, I want to back up for just a moment and look at the verse that we have on the slide. Let's read it together, verse 10, 11, and 12 and 13. To the married, I give instructions, not I, but the Lord. Let me stop a moment. If you're interested in that phrase, in comparison to verse 12, I say not the Lord. Get the audio of the lesson last Sunday morning. We talked about that. That's not going to be our focus tonight. But anyway, not I, but the Lord, that the wife should not leave her husband, and that the husband should not divorce his wife. But to the rest I say, not the Lord, that if any brother has a wife who is an unbeliever, he must not divorce her. And the woman who has an unbelieving husband, she must not send her husband away. One of the keys to this passage is this little phrase right here, to the rest. What's the idea of the to the rest? And so... Let's do this. I was hoping by making this slide you could see how this verse fits the first part to the last part. So you have the Lord gave instructions that the wife should not leave her husband. Now, to the rest. Who's to the rest? Now you'll note in red we have the brother who has a wife who is an unbeliever. And then we have the wife, the woman who has an unbelieving husband. That's the rest. So the Lord dealt generally with marriage and divorce. He didn't specify interracial marriages. He didn't specify whether one person was a virgin when they married someone that had no right to marry. He simply made a general statement that covered all marriages of all men of all time. In fact, he went back to Genesis 2. But what about people who, the wife who has an unbeliever, or the man who has an unbelieving wife, or the woman who has an unbelieving husband? That's the rest. And so now what Paul does is focus in on a specific group of people. Now, that doesn't mean what the Lord said doesn't apply to those people. They had this specific situation in Corinth, and the question would be, does what the Lord say apply to us? And so here's what we note when we look at this. Whoops, got the wrong one. Let me go back. Okay, so when we look at this now, we have... Here's what he said. Here's what the Lord said. So here's what the Lord said. Right here, and look down here what Paul said. The Lord said the wife should not leave her husband. What did Paul say? She must not send her husband away. Up here, specific relationship to an unbeliever is not mentioned. But it applies Paul said the same thing about relationships where one of the mates an unbelieving mate. All right? Same thing with the husband. Here's what the Lord said about the husband. The husband should not divorce his wife. What about the man who has an unbelieving wife? He must not divorce her. So this, you see, is the same thing the Lord said. And what was told to the wife is the same thing the Lord said. There's no difference. Neither one has the right to divorce. But the question might be, but does what the Lord say apply to our specific situation? And the answer is yes. So I don't know if that helps or not. It may not, but I thought I'd give that a shot and look at that for just a moment tonight. All right. And then we'll address ourselves to our lesson for tonight. All right. Back on 1 Corinthians chapter 7, if you got your Bible open. You've got this section of verses, verse 12 through 16, which, as we've just observed, deal with the specific situation where a believer is married to an unbeliever. And so he's addressing that. Now, when you get to verse 15 is a key verse in the study of marriage and divorce and remarriage. Verse 15 says, if the unbelieving one leaves, let him leave. The brother or sister is not under bondage in such cases. You may not have heard this phrase, but it's a common one, and people that write about this verse or talk about this verse, it's called the Pauline privilege. Paul, in other words, the writer, the Pauline privilege. And verse 15 is used. In Matthew 19, Jesus gave one exception. Remember that? Whoever puts away his wife and marries another commits adultery, except for one situation. Whoever puts away his wife except for fornication and marries another commits adultery. This verse 15 is made to say here's a second exception. So you marry an unbeliever, the unbeliever leaves. Bye. You're not under bondage. You're free now to marry who you wish. So in cases of divorcing a mate for fornication or in cases of desertion, you can remarry without sin. That's the position that's held. I do not believe verse 15 is talking about that, and hopefully I can explain why. All right, so look at your lesson. Now, I know that the first question I have may be confusing. My wife was doing her lesson and she asked me about it. And at first I didn't understand what the problem was, but then I did. So I've completely reworded it on the edited edition. So the way I've got it on your lesson, if the unbeliever does not leave, the believer must do what? Now I'm real curious, if you did the lesson, what was your answer? Anybody want to volunteer? I love Mark. All right. You may have put, must not send their mate away, which is not a wrong answer. But I'm looking for what Mark came up with. And so I reworded the question, the believer must not send the unbeliever away if the believer consents to do what? So look at the verse 12, and she consents to do what? Live with him, or as Mark said, remain. All right? Does the American Standard say remain? On verse 12?
It says live and not send her away.
No, but if the unbeliever, what? Consents to do what? Remain or what?
To live with him.
To live with? And the American Standard also? Anyway, it doesn't make any difference. That's the idea, to live with. Yes?
The American Standard says to dwell with.
To dwell with, okay? To dwell with. And the same thing in verse 13. So, this woman's got an unbelieving husband. He consents to live with her. That's what he's talking about. So, the unbeliever says, I know you've obeyed the gospel. You won't go drinking with me and partying with me and all of that, but I still want to be your mate. We'll live together as husband and wife. But what do? You don't divorce them. Now, we talked in our last class why that might even enter their minds, because there's the influence in the Corinthian church of Jews. And under Jewish law, you were not to marry foreign women. And if you did, according to both Ezra and Nehemiah, you were to get rid of them. But here, these people are not under Jewish law. And here he's saying, you've got an unbelieving mate. No, you don't send them away. You don't divorce. That's not what you do. If they'll live with you, you live with them. Now, when you get to verse 15, if the unbelieving one leaves. So here's one that's not consent to remain. He does not decide to live with the mate. Now what? Let him leave. The brother, sister, not under bondage. Now, that word is not the same word as in Romans 7, bound by law to your mate, or in the last verse in this chapter, bound by law. It's a word that has to do with being enslaved, but the idea is not slavery. It's the idea of service and devotion to a mate. So the unbeliever leaves. You are not obligated to be a husband or a wife to that person who left. You're not obligated to get a private detective, go find out why they are, where they are, rope tie them and bring them home. They left. You're not under bondage to live with them, to remain with them. They left. Now, if they're consent to stay, don't send them away. But if they leave, God has called us to peace. There's no reason to make get involved with the law and get somebody stronger than your mate to bring them back. That's not the idea. So if they leave, you're not under bondage. Now, my second question, if the unbeliever leaves, the believer's not in bondage or enslaved to do that. That is what the first question talked about. That is to remain with them, to live with them because they've left. And that's the context of verse 15. He is not talking about remarriage anywhere in verse 12 through 16. But that's the application that's made. They're not under bondage, so they can remarry. Do you find anything about remarrying in verse 12 through 16? Not one word, is there? Nothing. So it's a mistake to introduce into the text something Paul is not even mentioning. But that's the way verse 15 is used. And so I wanted to bring that to your attention. So, let's look at our question B here. We're not going to read those three verses. You're familiar with them. Matthew 5:32, Matthew 19:9, and Romans 7. All three of these do discuss remarriage. Verses 12 through 16 of Romans, 1 Corinthians 7 does not. These three verses do discuss remarriage in the case of a divorce. Now, if a woman is divorced by her husband and remarries, according to these three verses, she commits adultery. Why? Romans 7:2 says she's still bound by law to her husband as long as he lives. At the end of this chapter, look at verse 39. A wife is bound to as long as her husband lives. But if her husband is dead, she's free to be married to whom she will. So if he's dead, she's free to be married. But if he's alive, she's not free to be married. It doesn't make any difference whether he left or he's there. Of course, if he divorced her, he's going to leave or send her away, one of the two, likely. But the point is, as long as he's alive, she's bound. You can see that there's no freedom. The guy says, I'm going to Alaska. Bye. So now she's not under bondage, verse 15, and free to marry? No, she's not free to marry. She's still bound to that man. But she's not under bondage to go to Alaska, chase him down and bring him home or whatever, to live with him. So that's the idea. So these three verses clearly indicate what happens when a woman is divorced by her husband, she is not free to marry as long as that man lives. That's what Romans 7:2 says, and 1 Corinthians 7:39 says she's bound by law to the husband. All right, so I wanted to deal with those. Those are critical passages in the discussion of marriage, divorce, and remarriage. All right? Let's look down at verse 27. Here's another one. Critical passage. This whole chapter is on marriage and divorce. And here's another key verse. This version, I'm reading the New American Standard, 77 edition. Again, we remember we encourage you to compare versions. That can be very helpful. In any case, here's the way this one reads. Are you bound to a wife? By the way, that's a different word from the word bondage in verse 15. This word bound is the same one that this writer used in Romans 7 and this writer used in verse 39 of this chapter. It's a different word. I wouldn't base my whole argument on it's a different word. But the point is, it is different. And the fact is, he says something different in verse 15 because he's talking about bondage to live with, not freedom to remarry. But anyway, it is a different word. Are you bound to a wife? Do not seek to be released. Are you released from a wife? Do not seek a wife. But if you should marry, you have not sinned. All right. When you talk about released, that may connote in our language that you were bound. And now you're not bound anymore. Released. How can you release somebody that was not already bound? What's the idea of releasing? That's our word. That is not the connotation of the original word. It does not imply a previous binding. On your lesson, I've got some quotes. You'll see under C, 2C, I've got some quotes. And I've got a quote, first of all, you'll see it bold, and you'll see that RWP. What is RWP? That's Robertson's Word Pictures. You say, well, I thought you said not use commentators. We're not looking at his comment. A.T. Robertson was a scholar in the Greek language. And his comments about what Greek words meant and grammar can be very valuable. He's not interested in our discussion, but he talks about this word. And look what he says. Bachelors, as well as widowers, are included in, and that word that I have there is the word that's translated released. So when you read that word released, it may refer to somebody that's never been bound or even married, like a bachelor. So that's one prominent source for the meaning of the word. But there's another. That AGB. You see AGB in that next quote? That's Art and Gingrich and Bauer's Greek lexicon. It's a later lexicon than Thayer's. It's widely known and respected about Greek words. When they define Greek words, what they do is go back and look at the documents that they have available to see how people use those words back in that time period. And they're telling you, here's how those people use those words. That's what a modern dictionary does. It tells you how we use words today. And if 20 years from now you pick up that dictionary and read a definition, it may not fit because people use the word differently. Just like the word gay. If you looked up the word gay 50 years ago, you wouldn't find the definitions in the dictionary that you find today. And so they simply represent how people use a word. All right, so here's Art and Gingrich's lexicon. Note, he says, on this word that's translated in your Bible, released, are you free from a wife? That is, not bound to a wife. Note what they say in bold, a previous state of being bound need not be assumed. Now, why do I emphasize all of that? Here's why. Here's how this is used. Are you bound to a wife? In other words, you're married. You're bound by law. So, do not seek to be released. So understand that. Are you released from a wife? Do not seek a wife, but should you marry, you have not sinned. And the word released is made to mean divorced. And so you're bound to a wife. Now you're divorced. Once you're divorced, you are free to marry whoever you will. You ever heard that argument? If you've been here at least 15 years, I guarantee you have. Dealt with it in 2005. And so the idea that divorce frees a person. Now they can marry whoever they will. Why? Because he says here, if you marry, you haven't sinned. You've been released. And so the idea of release does not imply a previous marriage. I have a question on your lesson. Part 2D. How does Paul introduce the section beginning in verse 25? By the way, in your Bible, on verse 25, is the 25 in bold? What does that mean? In the translator's view, that's the beginning of a new paragraph. Often very helpful. If you have a paragraph type text, is probably set off either by indentation or a space. Now, sometimes I don't agree with their judgment about where a new paragraph starts, but it can be helpful. In this case, it's correct. In verse 25, he starts dealing with virgins, people who have not been married. And so you get to verse 27. Is he back to married people? The New International Version. I don't refer to the New International Version very much because it's oftentimes a paraphrase rather than a translation. But sometimes they hit the nail on the head. And here's how they translate this. Are you pledged to a woman? When we talked about an engagement, back when we were discussing the word marriage, when Joseph was engaged to Mary, he thought about doing what? Matthew 1. Putting her away. And that's the word that's translated divorce throughout the Bible. Does that imply he was married? No. He was not married. He was engaged. But he was bound by that commitment. See? But now he finds out that she's pregnant, figures she's been unfaithful, so he's going to sever that commitment that the engagement implies. Now, whether or not that's what Paul has in mind here, I can't be certain, but it makes sense because he started talking about virgins in verse 25. And so the New International says, are you pledged to a woman? Do not seek to be released. Are you free from such a commitment? Now, when you read in your version, and it says, are you released from a wife? You don't see from such a commitment. That's what I'm talking about. The New International Version often interprets for you. But if that is the idea, it makes sense. And he said, don't seek a wife. And of course, he's saying all of this in view of verse 26. Back up in verse 1 and 2, he encouraged people to avoid immorality by getting married. Is married, getting married good in God's eyes? How could you prove it? Genesis 1 and 2. God saw the man was alone. It was not good. So he made him a wife. All right. So the general rule is marriage is good. But here Paul is cautioning against it. Why? Verse 26. I think that this is good in view of the present distress for a man to remain as he is. That is, if you're a virgin, male or female, don't get married. Why? There's some kind of pressing issue. I don't know what it was. Persecution, maybe. Maybe economic pressure. But whatever it was, he says, he goes on to deal with this later. if you have a wife or a husband, you're going to be concerned about your mate. That's going to put pressure on you. If you're not married, you don't have that concern. So this is set in view of some particular circumstance that they would be facing. So when you get to verse 27 and 28, it is not throwing the door open, say, oh, well, if you're divorced, you can remarry. There's another way to prove that. Now, that number 2, A, B, and C. So look at number 2A. In verse 10 and 11, which we studied last class, the unmarried woman who left her husband is told to do what? Unmarried. If she was married, and now she's unmarried, and her husband's still alive, what's a word besides unmarried that describes her condition? Divorced. She is divorced. Is she free to marry? No. He says remain unmarried. Earlier in the chapter, he answers the construction that sometimes people put on verse 27. He's not saying if you marry, you haven't sinned. It would be sin. He says remain unmarried. Sin is a violation of the law. For her to marry, it would be sin. All right. Look at, if you remember from our reading, Matthew 5:32 and Matthew 19:9. So a man puts away his wife. Now, if she remarries, what does she do? Commits adultery. Why is it adultery if divorce, he divorced her, makes her free to marry, verse 28? That doesn't make sense. You see, verse 27 and 28 is not saying divorce frees a person to marry. All right? Then we have the third passage, Romans 7. This woman is married to a man, and the sex says she's bound by law to him as long as he lives, right? But then she goes and is joined to or becomes another man. That is, she marries somebody else. What is she? An adulteress. But wait, if she's no longer living with the first man, is she not free to marry? The answer is no. And to make verse 28 say that is contrary to what Paul wrote in Romans, what Jesus said in Matthew 5, and what Paul wrote in 1 Corinthians 7. Yes, Ronnie? Good point. Sometimes you can't tell exactly what he's saying, but you can tell what he's not saying. That's a good observation. I know what he's not saying in verse 28, that if you're divorced, it's okay to marry. But I guarantee you that's argued. Can you answer it? Be ready to answer why you don't believe that's true. Don't be led astray. 1 Thessalonians 5, verse 19 tells you to do what? Examine all things. Hold fast to what is good. Abhor that which is evil. Examine all things. Search the scriptures to see if the things being said are so. That's in Deuteronomy 3, right? Where's that at? Acts 17:11. That's right. The noble-minded Bereans. All right. So, John said, 1 John 4:1, test the spirits. Test people. Put them to the test. Nothing wrong with that. Now, people may not like to be put to the test. But that's our obligation. Whether he's a preacher or not a preacher, whether he's been to school or not been to school, doesn't make any difference. Whether he's a friend or not a friend. All right. Now look down at verse 39. Any comments before I go to verse 39? All right, we're looking at verse 39. A wife is bound. Same word, the same writer used, talking about the same subject in Romans 7. Same word. Okay? And so in Romans 7, he explained what binds her. What is it? Bound by what? Law. He's talking about the jurisdiction of law. God's law binds her. Binds her in the sense of obligation or in the sense of restraint. Which is it? Restraint. How do you know? I agree. How do you know? It's right here in this verse. How do you know?
If her husband dies, she's free.
That's right. To do what? To be married. So when she's bound, she's not free to be married. It's restraint, you see? It's the definitions in the verse. She's bound, that is, she's not free to be married. Not obligated to be a wife to. That's not the idea. But rather restrained. So a godly man puts away his wife for fornication. Is he free to be married? Yes. Matthew 19, verse 9. All right. Now, if the woman, the man's still alive, her husband's still alive, is still bound in the sense of obligation, you've got a problem, don't you? What's the problem? Yeah, two women have an obligation to one man. He marries the new wife lawfully, but now we have the other wife, the first wife, still obligated to be a wife to him. How can that be? That cannot be. But if you understand bound means restrained, it makes perfect sense. The second woman that he lawfully marries is bound by law to him, not free to marry somebody else. The first woman is still bound by law to him, not free to marry somebody else. The woman he's lawfully married to now has the obligation of a wife to him to fulfill the covenant they entered into when they entered into this relationship. And so, understanding words, their definition, is critical to understanding the Bible. That's the nature of human language. Human language is conveyed by means of words. Words have meanings, and we need to find out the meaning that the author or the writer had in mind when they used those words. So we have a second question. How long is the woman bound? That's a pretty easy one, isn't it? As long as the husband lives. But if verse 28 is interpreted to mean she's divorced and free to be married, she's released, and if she marries, she hasn't sinned, your answer conflicts with that. And so you can see again, you see verse 28 is not talking about in the case of divorce, you're free to marry who you will. All right. Now look at verse 40. In my opinion, she's happier if she remains as he is. Now, he discussed that previously. That's not a general rule. Always remember verse 26. That's a key passage in 1 Corinthians 7. He's writing in view of some distress. And so, you'll see in verse 32, I want you to be free from concern. The one who is unmarried is concerned about the things of the Lord, how he may please the Lord. The one who is married is concerned about the things of the wife, how he may please his wife, and his interests are divided. So, if there's pressure, outside pressure, for example, he wants to please the Lord, but man, he's got to please his wife, he wants to please her, and there's a divided interest. It makes it difficult at times. And I stand in admiration of people I know who face that daily in their marriages, but choose to put the Lord first. But that happens. And so he says, if you know ahead of time, and I'm telling you ahead of time, there's a present distress, it's best not to have that concern. That's his judgment. But you'll see that he said, although he said that in verse 26, if you choose to go ahead and marry, if you're free, if you're not bound, you haven't sinned. So divine counsel is, it's better not to, under the circumstances, but if you do, you haven't sinned. So, he says then, I think I also have the Spirit of God. Now sometimes you hear me talk about a verse and what I think it means. I say, I'm not sure. But that's not what he means by think here. I'm not sure. I'm working on it. Maybe someday I'll have an answer. That's not the meaning of think here. It's just the opposite. Put an exclamation point after it. I gave you some illustrations on your lesson. Look at Acts 5:36. Acts chapter 5:36. Before I read that verse, answer a question for me. When Jesus said, "Beware of the leaven of the Pharisees," did they understand what he was talking about? Why? Didn't understand figure of speech. That's right. Okay. And so, and he was a bit put out with them that he didn't understand, in fact, in that particular case. So here's Matthew chapter 5. So over here we read, I think I have the Spirit of God. But is that literal or is that figurative? All right. Look at Acts chapter 5 and verse 36. Some time ago, Judas rose up, claiming to be somebody. Do you know of any person on the face of this earth who doesn't claim to be somebody? Everybody claims to be somebody. But what does he mean by that? What does Luke mean by that?
He was over-exaggerating his importance.
Over-exaggerating his importance. And Luke, by understating it, emphasizes the very thing that he said. He claimed to be somebody. You know, you talk to somebody, you walk away, you see they've got a pride problem. Boy, he really thinks he's somebody. Well, yeah, don't you? You don't mean it that way, see? It's an understatement. And if you looked up the definition, as we suggested, you may have found this one. This is from Webster's Dictionary. To state with restraint for greater effect. That's what figures are used for oftentimes, for effect, for emphasis. All right, look at Luke 17:9. Now, if you have the American Standard, New American Standard, ESV, it won't work on this verse. But in the King James and New King James, you'll find a little statement. And why the difference? It's a manuscript difference, which manuscripts the translators prefer. But it serves our purpose. In Acts 17 and verse 9, in the New American Standard, it says, he does not thank the slave because he did the things which were commanded, does he? And in the King James and American Standard, it says, I think not. Does he say, is Jesus said, I don't think so, I'm not really sure, or is it, I think not? You know? Somebody calls you on the phone and say, boy, you've got a problem with your bank account. Give me your bank account number and we'll help you straighten it out. You might say, I think not. Ain't no way you're getting it, in other words. And so that's an understatement. Now, if you want a fancier word to describe it, it's a figure of speech called tapinosis. I'm not sure I'm pronouncing it right. Maybe tapinosis. But anyway, but that's how, E.W. Bullinger, who wrote the 1,000-page book on figures, he puts it under that category. And so if you want to look it up, you can go look that up if you want to do it on the web or whatever. So, look at right here in our chapter, 1 Corinthians 7:26. I think, is he expressing doubt or is he certain that it's good for a man to remain as he is? It's not a doubt thing. It's a judgment call, but he's certain about his judgment. Look down in chapter 4, verse 9. Look in chapter 4, verse 9. 1 Corinthians 4:9. Paul says, "For I think God has exhibited us apostles last of all." Is he not sure? A lot of this is figurative. And "I think" is not stating uncertainty, but certainty. The way we're treated, it looks like we're the scum of the earth. And then you have another place. Look at chapter 8, verse 2. "If anyone thinks," King James Version, or the New King James Version, "if anyone thinks he knows anything, he has not yet known as he ought to know." It's not a matter of, "I'm not sure if I know." He's talking about the Gnostic. He says, "I've got the knowledge, man. I know about this business of these meats. I know there's no such thing as another God." He's very confident in his knowledge. And to think is an exclamation point, not a question mark. So, when we look at 1 Corinthians 7:40, "I think I have the Spirit of God." He's not, "Well, I'm not sure." When he introduces this book in chapter 1:1, how does he introduce it? An apostle of Jesus Christ. An apostle is guided by the Holy Spirit. In chapter 2, when he wrote in chapter 2 about the things that he spoke, in verse 12. "Now we have received not the spirit of the world, but the spirit who's from God, that we might know the things freely given to us of God, which things we also speak, not in words taught by human wisdom, but of those taught by the Spirit." What's that? What's one word that describes that in our language?
Inspired.
What?
Inspired.
Inspired. That's right. Inspired. And so, look at chapter 14. Look at verse 37. "If anyone thinks he's a prophet or spiritual, let him recognize that the things which I write to you are the Lord's commandment." Paul has no doubt about his inspiration. He's very certain from chapter 1, verse 1, all the way through the book. Okay, our time is up. Thank you for your attention and comments. Lord willing, we'll continue our study Sunday morning. Thank you.